Hello everyone, welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, the famous Blah podcast with Stefan Sasse, who is a contributor to the Tower of the Hand and creator of the Dance with Dragons reread blog. With me, as always, today is...
I'm Sean T. Collins. I write the Song of Ice and Fire blog, All Leather Must Be Boiled, at boiledleather.com. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone. And I co-wrote the official annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia and Anne Grohl for the Subtext iPad app. And joining us today is a very, very special guest that we're quite excited to have, Alyssa Rosenberg from Think Progress in The Atlantic. Actually, Alyssa, why don't you introduce yourself instead of letting me do it?
That's the sum, pretty much the sum total of it. I am the culture blogger for thinkprogress.org, and so I get to joke that I work at a think tank and I run the Game of Thrones division, which is
a noble calling.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today. It's a real treat to be with you guys.
Thank you for joining us. The sort of reason for this episode and the reason we had Alyssa join us is the essay that she contributed to a really, really good book called Beyond the Wall. It's edited by James Lowder. It comes out on Tuesday from Smart Pop and Ben Bella. And it's a collection of essays exploring various aspects of A Song of Ice and Fire, sort of also touching into different adaptations, the comic and the television show, from a whole variety of very interesting writers, both within the world of A Song of Ice and Fire and fantasy in general, and then just sort of the larger pop culture realm. In addition to Alyssa, there's Elio Garcia and Linda Antonsen from Westeros.org. There's very fantasy authors like Ari Salvatore and Daniel Abraham, who adapted Game of Thrones into the comic, Adam Whitehead from WurtZone, so it's quite an august assemblage of people. And when I received a review copy of the book and read through it, I was really impressed by virtually everything in it. But one of the real standouts to me was Alyssa's essay, which tackles a very difficult subject and a very contentious subject amongst the fandom and amongst sort of the larger audience that's reacted to the books and the show, and that is... essentially sexual assault and what that means for women in the world of Westeros and the narrative role it plays and sort of the message being sent. You know, and obviously if you've spent any time whatsoever immersed in this fandom, which chances are if you're listening to this podcast you have, you know that this is a very hotly debated topic. And I just found, and I think Stefan agreed, that this essay was really a very insightful, I would say almost definitive look at this topic. So, Alyssa, I was just wondering if you could sort of walk us through a little bit and give us sort of the basics on what you were saying about this.
Well, that's first off lovely of you to say. It was a real treat to write the essay because I started writing about A Song of Ice and Fire a couple of years ago when my readers at my old blog sort of encouraged me to check the books out and wrote a week of essays. And one of the subjects that I've been grappling with since I started reading the books is how rape and sexual assault, and to a lesser extent domestic violence, are portrayed in the novels, because the novels frequently take on these issues. And you know, for some readers, it's too much. It's reading the depictions and ruminations on these assaults is triggering. The sort of omnipresence of them is overwhelming. And I really understand why people reading the books may not be able to get beyond that. I would never tell anyone to read something that makes them feel uncomfortable or upset, but rereading the books, reconsidering them in conversation with people, I've really come to believe that sexual assault is one of the main things that George R. R. Martin is writing about in the novels, and that it's a way of distinguishing monsters in Westeros. There are sort of two very prominent examples of this. First is Gregor Clegane, who is the Mountain Who Rides, and you know, the signal act that kind of distinguishes him as a monster character in this universe, is that when he's sent to kill the remaining members of the Targaryen royal family, he rapes Aelya Targaryen before he murders her and commits infanticide, killing her children. And that act becomes sort of political football in Westeros. Tywin Lannister, who was Clegane's commanding officer at the time, is very eager not to be blamed for having ordered that. He wasn't having ordered the murder of children, but rape is the thing that is over the moral line. The fact that Clegane is sort of still accepted as a member of polite Westeros society is, you know, somewhat controversial. Rape becomes the big thing that he, you know, Oberyn Martell tries to sort of avenge his sisters with death and sexual assault. And ultimately, Clegane's sort of willingness, almost glee, at claiming responsibility for the sexual assault is one of the ways that we know that he is really a monstrous figure. And then the same becomes true in the novel's exploration of Ramsay and Roose Bolton. Roose Bolton is a significant lord in the North who got Ramsay in an act of rape. He understands it as sort of exercising his lord's right to a first night with a newly married woman. But really what it is he, you know, asserts his right to have sexual intercourse with this woman, whether she's willing or not. A child is ultimately born of their affair, I can't believe I just called it an affair, of their night together. And the sort of, there is this understanding from the beginning that that child, Ramsay Bolton, bears the blood taint. He is, you know, he's a bastard born of rape. And so this blood taint that Ramsay is supposed to have manifests itself in that he becomes sort of the most accomplished sexual sadist that we encounter in the books. He regularly rapes, hunts down, and flays peasant women. When he gets married, we see him, sexually mistreating both Theon Greyjoy, who's in his captivity, and his bride, the fake Arya Stark. There's this sense that, you know, rape is a sin that passes from generation to generation. This is, to a certain extent, an old-fashioned attitude. I mean, obviously, it's not, people get their own moral start in lives, but there is a sense of sort of lingering horror around sexual assault. And those are sort of two of the big examples of, you know, actual monstrosity that I discuss in the essay. But, you know, there are these constant signs that where rape happens, society has broken down. One of the ways that we know the Night's Watch has fallen apart when it rebels against the Lord Commander is that, you know, the brothers in the Night's Watch break their vows of chastity and rape Craster's wives. Sexual assault is a significant feature of the riot in King's Landing, where Lawless Stokeworth is raped and the High Septon is murdered. Rape is kind of this thing that correlates both with monstrosity and anarchy in the novels, and I think it's read sort of soberly and in detail, it's impossible not to understand sexual assault as a major theme of Martin's work and one of the ways that he sort of understands civilization's functioning and monstrosity. So that was what I was trying to get across in the essay. Whether I succeeded or not will be up to hopefully hordes of readers who actually buy the book.
I think one of the things that I liked and responded to about the essay was, your sort of argument that in inserting these scenes and this issue into the book with such frequency, Martin's sort of depending on our ability to interpret the message being sent. Stefan and I have talked about this many times with many different issues, but it's come up in particular with leaders who are responsible either directly or indirectly for sexual assault and rape. Victarion Greyjoy and Tywin Lannister are the ones we always keep coming back to. We started this podcast in large part because we were kind of baffled/horrified by the segment of the fandom that sort of celebrated people like that as ideal leaders. You know, Tywin is the best lord in all the books. Victarion Greyjoy is a possible Azor Ahai messiah figure. We just didn't understand that because it seemed so clear to us that their behavior is intended to be, we're intended to find their behavior reprehensible. And I just found it so gratifying and useful that the way you sort of make the case systematically about what rape means to the characters and also sort of by extension to the audience when we encounter it.
Well, and I mean, I think this is something that I didn't really have space to discuss, but that I would have liked to spend more time with, and that I think the show hasn't necessarily done a good job of communicating. But there is a real contrast between, you know, the sort of joyful, consensual sexuality that we see in the books between Jon Snow and Ygritte, between, you know, sort of a happily married Kat and Ned, and the sort of miserable sort of memories or stories of sexual assault. Because one of the things that's interesting about the books is that sexual assault is never, we never see it while it's happening. It's something that is remembered or told in story or heard about later. And I think that's, you know, I'm always sort of befuddled when people say that they think that, you know, Martin has written these scenes to be creepy or sexually gratifying, because we don't actually see them happen. And the memories of them are always sort of miserable or tainted or told with fear. I mean, you know, I think one of the most powerful ways that Martin makes Cersei Lannister somewhat more sympathetic in the novels is explaining that she was the repeated victim of marital rape.
Yeah, I think maybe people gloss over that fact because Robert is obviously a much more charismatic and sympathetic character in general than Cersei is, certainly in terms of his role towards the characters we consider protagonists, like the Starks. Cersei is an antagonistic figure, and Robert is essentially an ally, a flawed ally, but, you know, he's Ned's best friend. You know, most of the sort of misdeeds we see him do, he does sort of at Cersei's urging, or to placate the Lannisters. So I think the fact that he did abuse Cersei is ignored, and not just in terms of its effect on Cersei, but also its effect on Joffrey, who, you know, as you detail in the essay, is himself a sexual sadist, you know, and you know, is sort of brought just short of some really ugly, you know, behavior towards Sansa. But I think, you know, oftentimes we blame Cersei for that because she sort of looks the other way with the fact that there's something very wrong with this child. But Cersei's not his only parent. He was also looking up to Robert, who he believed to be his father, and surely saw Robert's excessive drinking and his abusive, emotionally and at times physically abusive treatment of Cersei as well.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that's an important point to make too.
I also want to underline once again the importance of Alyssa's argument about the rape scenes never really happening in the book, because that's something that the essay gave to me. I wasn't aware of the fact, really, that all these sexual assaults never happen on screen, so to speak. And it makes for a really good threat whenever something like that could happen, like when Jaime and Brienne are captured. The threat of sexual assault against Brienne is always in the air, and it gives the scene a very intense moment. Or when she fights Rorge and Biter back in the woods, and there simply is this danger that they really are going to rape her in a very ugly fashion, that it becomes sort of a very, very strong theme. And much more dangerous than just usual "I will kill you" stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, these stories are always told from the victims' perspectives. They're always told. I mean, you know, I think there are some people who see Tyrion sort of as a participant. I mean, Tyrion is obviously a participant in his wife Tisha's gang rape. But he's also a victim. I mean, he's being forced to do this by his father. He is having sex under coercion. And so, you know, we hear about that again and again from Tyrion's perspective. And he sort of sees himself as a collaborator rather than as a victim. And I think sort of working through that is one of the things we've seen him do in the novel. We hear about, you know, Robert's assault on Cersei from Cersei's perspective. We, you know, the ways that Theon is forced to, you know, participate in sexual assaults on, you know, fake Arya. All of these things are just shown as having these devastating permanent impacts on their victims. There's a real, you know, respect for that testimony and experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is also important to note that the role of rape within Westerosi society has also kind of a natural catastrophe character to it. Because you pointed out that people committing rape are socially dead most of the time. I mean, Gregor Clegane, for example, and to a certain extent Rhaegar Targaryen, because he is the one who raped Lyanna, at least in the official version. And on the other hand, it so frequently happens during wartime especially, and it is regarded not as a thing you have to condemn morally then, although that's there too, but mostly it's like stuff like that happens in war when men get aggravated after a battle. It's just normal. And it is like if the flood comes, you get washed away. And they simply accept it as something that happens, and that is frightening as well in its own way.
I think that's a great point, because another one of the parts of Alyssa's essay that I really got a lot out of is, you know, Alyssa, you sort of break down how the different cultures that we encounter view rape, and what that tells us about those cultures. You know, the sort of broad consensus among the Seven Kingdoms versus the Ironborn, versus the Wildlings, versus the Dothraki, and sort of other, and versus like the Slaver's Bay cultures. And there's a difference, and I think that you're right, that in general, the degree to which a society is sort of out in the open about the abuse of women, the sexual abuse of women, tells us a lot about that society. But at the same time, Stefan's right, and I think, Stefan, maybe what you're alluding to specifically was a really chilling paragraph when Jaime Lannister is riding back to King's Landing, escorted by Roose Bolton's man, Steelshanks Walton, who he says, you know, this is a guy who, you know, he'll slaughter, he'll rape when his blood's up after a battle, but then after the war's over, he'll go home, he'll raise a family, he'll farm. You know, and that seems to be the prevailing Westerosi view of rape in the context of war, that while we decry and sort of ostracize people who, you know, like Ramsay Bolton and Gregor Clegane, the monsters, who are sort of ostentatious about this, there's a degree to which everybody looks the other way when it happens in war or when it happens you know, maybe in a marital context where I don't think they even understand marital rape as rape.
Well, that's one of the interesting questions in this franchise, right? I mean, a lot of these characters have differing opinions on, you know, under what circumstances does something count as rape and sort of who can be raped, right? I mean,
yeah.
Robert sort of believes that a wife can't be raped. I would sort of assume that's reflective of, you know, the sort of noble view of sexuality that, you know, marriage is consent and, you know,
right.
Once you're married, you are not capable of being raped. If you are a peasant girl, I suppose you can be raped, but your rape doesn't sort of count as an a sort of violation of your womanhood. You don't have anything that is worth defiling, so a rape doesn't count quite the same way. And you see these sort of varied attitudes, but they're all horrible. They're all upsetting. There's no, you know, Martin doesn't sort of privilege one of these attitudes more than the other. Instead, he breaks down the ways that all of these assumptions are wrong.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that was all I was going to say.
Oh. I think that because Martin has said things to the effect that, you know, Ned Stark is a good person, but that doesn't make you a good ruler, there's a degree to which the audience has sort of extrapolated that as sort of an endorsement of, you know, sort of bad behavior, you know, ends justify the means, in other words. Now, I don't really understand what ends would justify the means of rape, but I do think that there's a sort of an error that the fandom can tend towards. We're sort of looking the other way at really horrendous violations of human rights and just sort of the sort of sanctity of the human person because of the way that the books have sort of incorporated realpolitik and a sort of more realistically awful treatment of war than you get from the typical epic fantasy. There's a sort of tendency to sort of brush a lot of that stuff off. But I think you're right. It's very clear that, you know, to the degree that that's a theme in the books, like, Martin is horrified by this behavior in the real world, and that's why he's writing about it in this fantasy.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that there's, you know, this is something I discussed in my essay in a little bit that we haven't gotten to, but there's also the fact that sort of the war that brings Robert Baratheon to the throne, yes, is based on the fact that the Targaryens were going nuts and committing atrocities. It's also, to a certain extent, based on a false belief that, or a potentially false belief, that Lyanna Stark is the victim of sexual assault. And this is a case where, you know, her voice is kind of invisible in this. We have very little sense of her person. And, you know, she and Rhaegar run off, or he kidnaps her. It's not particularly clear. But, you know, it's a case where men make a bunch of decisions or assumptions about sort of a woman's sexual autonomy or preferences or behavior, run off, have an enormous war, and there's this lingering question over the series of, is it rape? Is it, you know, Robert feeling this ownership over Lyanna that he's been denied? I mean, this is kind of the big mystery of the series, which I find sort of fascinating.
Yeah, particularly because it ties in, you know, as we eventually discover, to the sort of prophetic material that's sort of the fantasy core of the entire story. You know, this sort of, the dragon has three heads and the prince that was promised and stuff. You know, so the question of whether Rhaegar raped Lyanna or whether there was something else going on entirely, you know, it's obviously very important to the individuals involved, from Lyanna on down. It's important in terms of the politics and the casus belli for the Robert's Rebellion, and it's also central to, you know, the Song of Ice and Fire, the, you know, prophetic spine of the entire narrative. And that's you know, I think we ignore that at our peril. The fact that that's the kind of issue that's at the center of everything.
I think it is also very noteworthy that the sexuality of a woman is very much tied to the honor and the power base of each house. Because if you forcefully take a noble woman, just the abduction itself is a statement against the house she belongs to, because the honor of a man in Westerosi society, especially knights but also lords and other men, demands that they protect their women. Protect women is a very important thing, at least in theory, in the honorable code of Westeros. And if you then rape her, you really demolish the honor of said house, which then has to retaliate in a very strong fashion to restore that honor. So if Robert believes that Rhaegar Targaryen abducted and raped Lyanna, it is also a very large hit he's taking here, not only for his personal relationship, which might or might not be genuine. I would think it is, but it doesn't really matter in that context anymore, because you have to lash out, you have to defend it, and to really exact revenge on those guys who did it. And I think that this part also contributes to this theme that rape is not allowed, that it makes you a social outsider.
But it's also interesting because, you know, what Robert believes he's protecting Lyanna from is not, like, the denial of her sexual autonomy, right? I mean, there's not a vision of this where, you know, he wants to make sure that Lyanna isn't raped so she can make her own decisions, or, you know, so she can decide who she wants to marry or who she wants to sleep with. It's so that she can belong to him.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is sort of one of the things that's always, you know, the term sort of white knighting has a negative connotation in kind of nerd culture today. It's someone sweeping in and protecting someone who, you know, doesn't need protecting, or, you know, sweeping in solely for one's self-aggrandizement. And there's a lot of that happening here. And, you know, when women in the novels, you know, women who exercise their sexual autonomy or who sort of have articulated clear sexual desires are kind of unnerving to men a lot of the time. You know, John finds Ygritte unsettling, you know, both because she's a threat to his vows, but because, you know, she's not really like anyone who's met before. She knows very directly what she wants in a way that would just be totally unfathomable to John's sisters or mother, or, you know, even if they wanted things, that kind of tamp them down. You know, Dany's kind of sexual free agency during her time, you know, in Marine is disconcerting to the people around her. The fact that she, you know, has this affair before she's married, you know, is both sort of treated as a sign of irresponsibility or, you know, it's this very, you know, a woman's sexual power is unhinged, is this kind of dangerous thing. Cersei, you know, Cersei has this affair with her cousin, with these, you know, various sort of mediocre hedge knights, that then, you know, sort of come back and are used against her. And, you know, I think there might be a clearer argument here that, you know, the Martin's treatment of sort of sexually free women is less than rah-rah empowering. But it's also, you know, an interesting example, you know, if you're a woman, what happens when you try to live totally beyond the rules that are laid out for you, that are meant to govern your chastity and your agency? And the answer is that the results are pretty bad. This is a patriarchal system that's pretty good at defending itself, that, you know, can put you in jail for the crime of the High Septon thinking you're a slut. you know, you can be literally paraded naked before the city if you are, you know, Cersei's conspiracies and her, you know, sort of sexual exercise of choice are kind of treated as equal sins by the people who have power around her.
Yeah, that's the whole interesting thing about this system of beliefs, of ideology, that really justifies how you have power in Westeros. Because you can't, there is really no chance to be an individual and to dominate your own sex life, because as you pointed out, you belong to the man you are wed to, and it can't be any other way, because in the noble system, in the feudal system of Westeros, the heir is of utmost importance, and if you don't have the guarantee that the woman you have married is only sleeping with you, you are inviting all sorts of problems later on when it comes to the line of succession. And so they can't allow within that system for noble women to be independent at all. It is simply impossible. And that is a real problem. And of course, in the same context, they can't regard marital rape as rape at all, because it is the duty of the woman to bear sons, because that's what the marriage is for. Love doesn't play a part in it. If it happens, like with Caitlin or Ned, yeah, that's fine, but it is by no means any condition for a working marriage.
It's a bonus, not the point.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, because a marriageable woman for a noble house is an asset like Valyrian steel. You know, the women are essentially property. I mean, I think all people in Westeros have very proscribed lives, including the noble men, you know, as we see from people like Jon or like Samwell or like Tyrion, who don't quite fit in, and even people like Jaime who do. You know, there's a psychic toll taken by the system, even on the most privileged people, the men, you know, men of noble houses. But at the same time, they still get to, when they're lords, they get to make the decisions. The women don't. The women really never rise above the level of, like, really well-treated property at best. So, yeah, of course, Robert has to sort of tear the realm apart on behalf of Lyanna, because Lyanna, you know, losing Lyanna is like you know, losing Storm's End, or, you know, losing, you know, like, if you know, their Valyrian sword, like, it's...
Your princess is in another castle.
Exactly. You know, and that can't be allowed to stand, because, you know, it's an affront, you know, as we discussed earlier, it's an affront to the honor of the house, but it's also, like, a material loss to the house. You know, because, you know, particularly, we did a whole episode a few podcasts back about this theory that Lady Dustin advances, that, you know, there's this whole conspiracy of intermarriages between the great houses prior to Robert's Rebellion. You know, and if that sort of thing is true, or even if it isn't, you know, you need to be you as the male lord of your house need to be free, quote unquote, to marry off your children, particularly your daughters, to whomever you see fit, because that's, you know, you cement your power that way. And in that system, there's really just no room for sexual autonomy, or sort of sexual privacy, or anything like that for the characters. And just phrasing it like that just now made me think that the tradition of the wedding and the bedding, which I think, you know, as readers, or certainly I've always had a tendency to find, like, just kind of funny and bawdy and just kind of like a neat bit of world building. But it has kind of a sinister undertone, which is that everyone at the wedding needs to make sure that these two people fucked to ensure that the transaction cleared. You know, it's like signing the credit card receipt, essentially. You know, and so that's kind of a grim, you know, that everyone's making jokes and it's kind of racy and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there's sort of a very bitter aftertaste to that.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that beddings are, you know, beddings become the settings for two of the most horrific events in the novel. You know, the Red Wedding is, you know, enabled by a sort of raucous bedding that takes some of the Starks' defenders out of the way. And then, you know, Ramsay's bedding of Jane Poole, a fake Arya, is, you know, the sort of, it's not as sort of public a massacre, but it's this sort of spiritual death for two of the people involved. I mean, there's this very deliberate undermining of that as this sort of jolly thing. It's, you know, it's...
And then we also get, you know, with Tyrion's marriage to Sansa, you know, he refuses to have the whole rigmarole of people carrying them to the bedroom and stripping off their clothes out of deference to both his own dignity and to Sansa's. You know, but I think, you know, I've seen people discuss his, you know, very apparent physical attraction to 13-year-old Sansa as sort of one of the most troubling aspects of Tyrion as a character. And, you know, I think we're clearly meant to confront that as readers. You know, Martin has been very clear that Tyrion is sort of one of his favorite characters, and, you know, when he's flattering himself, he's the character that he identifies with the most because of his wit. So there's something obviously troubling about how that scene plays out. And then also, speaking of troubling beddings involving the Lannisters, we're learning that Tywin's bedding with Joanna involved what sounds an awful lot like a sexual assault by the Mad King against Joanna, you know, in the past, that sort of helped lead to the falling out between Tywin and Aerys, and is potentially a source of speculation for the true parentage of some, you know, of either Jaime and Cersei or Tyrion later on. So yeah, I had never thought of it before, but there is sort of there's a tendency for that to go very, very badly wrong in a very, very prominent way.
There might also be a little detail left to the bedding process, provided that they are really getting stripped totally in the process. I mean, it's never really clear how much clothes are removed in the process. But if they get the woman naked entirely, also everyone can check upon her virginity. And, I mean, that's a big deal in such a society.
Yeah.
And it provides proof for everyone. I could imagine, especially if Marjorie gets wet, that this part would take a certain importance in the whole process.
I'm not that far in my reread, but isn't that something that actually happens? Like, don't they, when Marjorie and Cersei are arrested, like, don't they, like, God help us, inspect her, essentially?
Yeah, the Faith does it, but yeah. It's not publicly done at the wedding.
Yeah.
Right, and I mean, you know, her hymen isn't intact,
right.
And she gets to blame it on the, you know, age-old upper-class girl thing, but I was horseback riding, which of course is a way that you can break your hymen. It's totally legit.
That, by the way, I think is also shot across the bow from Martin against the Catholic Church. I think that the faith of the Seven is very clearly an analog for Roman Catholicism, and particularly in A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, sort of the behavior of the new radicalized High Septon is sort of Martin shaking out his issues from being a Catholic kid back in the day. But as a lapsed Catholic myself, maybe that is, of course, how I would read that. But,
yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out sort of stand-ins for all the faiths is complicated.
Right. Right.
You know, as the nerdy Jew in the conversation, I'm not not sure how that all maps together. But yes, that certainly seems possible.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought up white knighting earlier, because that is actually the note that I had written down for Robert and Lyanna, the concept of white knighting. And, you know, I think we see that several times throughout the story. I think that that's obviously going on with Jaime, who's a literal white knight when he rides to the rescue of Brienne, you know, to sort of save her from Vargo Hoat and his horrible crew. But I think the most prominent example that we actually see on the page is done by a woman for another woman, Daenerys rescuing, quote-unquote, Miri Mazdur from Drogo's men, and how all that plays out. And, you know, Daenerys' sensitivity to sexual assaults, you know, presumably based, you know, just sort of on a generalized ability to feel empathy, which is sort of a distinguishing characteristic of Daenerys versus other leaders that we encounter, but also due to her personal history, I would imagine. You know, that ends up being a fairly complex depiction of how an attempt to rectify cultures that in which sexual assault and rape are endemic can shake down. Do you have any thoughts about that in particular, Alyssa?
I do. I mean, I find Danny really interesting because, I mean, this was something that people sort of joked about during this season of the television adaptation, that, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to see why anyone would root for Dany, since she's essentially wandering through, my dragons, and not doing anything. But, you know, Dany is someone who's attempting to sort of push through a program of reform without much sort of interest or curiosity in any of the local cultures she's trying to change, or without any real understanding of how deeply entrenched privilege is in any of the societies that she's touched. And, you know, Dany and Viserys, for all that they had a kind of tumultuous childhood, are exceedingly, just insanely privileged people. And, you know, Dany doesn't really understand anything about oppression or power. You know, she, in her own way, through this sort of assertion of dynastic authority, you know, she assumes that sort of naturalist claims to power are bad when they aren't hers. I mean, her claim is unassailable, but those Dothraki who think that they get to rape the women when they conquer the landmen, or, you know, these wise masters who want to, you know, have sexual control over their bed slaves. Their claims couldn't possibly be right or just. You know, there's this sort of core contradiction in Danny's view of the world.
That's interesting thing, because we had more or less come down to the same conclusion in one of our first podcasts.
Yeah.
When we stated, I don't know whether it was me or Sean, to be honest, that Danny could change the whole social structure of Westeros and Essos as long as she stays queen. That's the conditio sine qua non, to speak in Latin, the condition without she can't do anything. She is queen, and the whole rest, this is really up to debate, but that one isn't.
Yeah, and when you brought up, you know, the fact that she and Viserys grew up privileged, initially I was like, oh, well, it seems like they had kind of a harrowing childhood, and that's certainly true, but we have a counter example to what life is like for a child on the run in the person of Arya, who no one knows is Arya of House Stark. She's just a kid roaming around, and we see how awful life is for her, how she's constantly at risk of being murdered, you know, that she's always being threatened with sexual assault when people think she's a little boy, when people think she's a little girl, pretty much no matter what's going on. She's hugely vulnerable. And Viserys and Daenerys, you know, lived a life on the lam as well. But because everybody knew they were who they were, they seem to have, you know, almost surprisingly, well, they obviously were never just outright murdered. And I think you're right. That's because people knew who they were, and even though they had been deposed, and even though House Targaryen had fallen on extremely bad times, there still is a degree of, there's an aura attached to them that protected them. So it's difficult.
And one of the things that becomes interesting in A Dance with Dragons is that, you know, we have this emergence of another potentially fake Targaryen, but he kind of underlines an important point, which is that the people who sort of invest in and support you know, anybody in the Targaryen succession are invested less in those people for themselves. I mean, yes, you know, there are people who believe that Dany herself would be a good, kind, compassionate queen, mostly though it's the last name. You know, there's no particular investment in these people for their qualities by their major backers. And by contrast, you know, I hadn't really thought of Arya as a counterpart to Dany, but when people invest in Arya, it's for herself. I mean, you know, the Hound comes to kind of respect her for her toughness. You know, Jaqen H'ghar and the folks at the House of the Black and White, you know, kind of see her qualities. You know, they don't want a Stark. They don't want to lead a Stark restoration. If they like her, it is for herself.
Right. And, you know, that's exceedingly rare, just in general, because as we discussed, you know, women are sort of viewed as objects first and subjects second, if at all. And Arya, you know, through, you know, a fairly unfortunate set of circumstances, is able to sort of depend on her own personhood in a way that, you know, even someone at the height of power like Cersei Lannister, or to a lesser extent Daenerys, really never could, because they can't escape that, you know, they'll never be able to sort of define themselves just on their own terms, in terms of what they're able to do, how their mind works, you know, what their skills are.
Well, there's very much a thread that when people are sort of stripped of their sexuality or their sexual agency, that can be extremely liberating. Like, one of the reasons Brienne of Tarth is able to sort of be a badass and go where she wants is that she's kind of locked up her sexuality and put it in a box and has the ability to defend that box. You know, she can be autonomous because she is, to a certain extent, degendered. She is, you know, has kind of blown up her own sexual value as a noble lady. Arya, you know, has become, you know, spends a bunch of the novels disguised as a boy, and then once she's in training, actually spends a lot of her time disguised as an ugly girl in some fashion. You know, again, she's put off her sexual value as a noble lady. And, you know, whether we get to see an Arya with an affirmed sexuality later is very much an open question. But, you know, that is, there's this counterpoint between these women who sort of both retain their noble privilege and exercise their sexuality, who often get punished, but these women who kind of leave that part of their lives behind, that's kind of the only way you can be freed. Unless you're a wildling, or you're Alice Karstark, who I think is going to be totally, like, Alice Karstark is currently who I want to be when I grow up.
She's got a lot of chutzpah, I'll say that for her.
I know, and I think, like, she and Magnar of Thenn are going to have, you know, kind of a hot, sexually happening marriage. They seem pretty compatible.
When you mention Alice Karstark, I just take it as an opportunity to pose a question I have lying on my tongue for some time now. Do the wildlings know the concept of rape?
That is an interesting question. You know, I think there's this... The whole concept of stealing your bride is obviously not particularly warm and fuzzy and consent-oriented. Tamora Pierce has an extended discussion of sort of wife stealing as practice in The Will of the Empress, one of her Winding Circle books, which I really recommend for people who sort of enjoy this universe, but that's a side note. I'm trying to think, I mean, do we have an instance of a rape being committed by a wildling? I mean, Craster's sort of sexual thraldom of his daughters is incestuous.
Yeah, but he's not a typical wildling. I mean, all the wildlings agree on that, so I would rule him out for this instance.
Yeah, in fact, I think maybe to use the sort of Rosenbergian framework, it's Craster's rape of his daughters that signals his monstrousness to the other wildlings. I don't remember who said this, but one of the wildlings says that there's sort of a saying among them that you can have a wife or a knife. You can't have both. And there's an expectation that all of the wildling women, aside from sort of subcultures like the Thens that are work differently from the quote-unquote free folk, I think women and girls are raised to understand that they have a right to fight and, they owe the people who steal them their sexuality.
There's the whole subtext of how, Stannis and his wife deal with Val, because they really just sort of expect that their concept of sort of nobility and sexual submission, applies, and John kind of reflects that, if you marry Val off to someone she doesn't like, she's not going to have, a noble, quiet bedding. She's not going to submit to her marital rape. She will gut the guy.
Right. So I think that, the times that we do see wildlings associated with rape, it's in the context of people from the south of the wall expressing their fears about the wildlings, of what raiding parties that cross the wall do, what would happen if the wall should fall,
really have available concrete evidence there's a casual or formalized acceptance of sexual assault.
Yeah, I think that it's, the people from the south of the wall, if their daughters were stolen by a wildling raider, those women have not been raised the way the wildling women have to, they have not been told to defend themselves. They have, they've sort of been raised to sort of meekly submit to whoever they end up being married to. So the sort of Southron imagination can't conceive of that relationship being anything other than rape. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's something problematic does not really do justice to the notion of stealing your wife. But there's, at the same time, amongst the wildlings, an ability for women to conceive of their sort of, having control over their sexuality and being able to fight for that, that the women of Westeros proper just have not been raised to have at all.
Well, there's also a sense that sort of the wife stealing that goes on among wildlings is a way of for the men to demonstrate to women that they are sort of capable strategists and providers.
Right.
It is not for the benefit of sort of outsiders. It's not aimed at her father.
involves a violation of her person, but it's almost part of her, you know, it's almost part of the process of her deciding whether she wants to consent. It's screwed up, but it is aimed, at least in theory, at sort of giving the woman more information.
Yeah, it's a courting ritual, in essence. You know, it's show like, hey, I'm a badass. I stole you, didn't I?
Right.
Like, don't you love me now?
It is also a very, very, what's the word? You have an inversion of the Westerosi of the customs of the South, because all that goes along with stealing a wife and not requiring consent, not only from the wife herself, but also from her father, it really destroys everything that is in the society system of the South. You simply can't have houses, you can't have arranged marriages, because the process, the ritual itself, defies everything about it. So it might also be a reaction to the customs of the South, in a way.
Right, right. Yeah, you're right, that's very, I mean, you it's just, the two systems are sort of anathema to one another. You know, they both have their, I suppose they both have pros and cons, but you're right, they're completely incompatible, and that's become a plot point within A Dance with Dragons as they try and sort of use the, you know, try and make connections between the nobility south of the wall and whatever the equivalent of nobility is north of the wall, trying to find, you know, a point of compatibility has obviously proven very difficult. Although, as you say, you know, the Fens being perhaps the one culture that has sort of an understanding of lordship as sort of divinely ordained or whatever, you know, that's the one group of wildlings that's like, okay, we can see how an intermarriage between, you know, a noble lady from south of the wall and a noble lord or whatever, Magnar, from north of the wall could work in that context. But, you know, with someone like Val, just speaking another language.
But I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I find Alice Karstark this sort of radical and invigorating figure, is that she's someone who, you know, I mean, she is almost a counterpoint to Dany, in that, in sort of the way that she sees towards reform. She flees this marriage that she finds just totally unacceptable. You know, she brings information to the wall, and she ends up sort of accepting a marriage that, you know, it still functions within the system that would have married her to someone she didn't like, but that gives her autonomy and that creates this bridge between the wildlings and the northern lords. She, you know, she accepts sort of a, she simultaneously accepts the system and kind of nudges it forward. Her marriage becomes a means of reform. And, you know, that marriage is happy, it's fun, there's a sexual spark to it. If anything, she's sort of more ready to get married than her husband is.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, Dany wants to sort of fiat that things be different, and it's interesting seeing women who agree that it would be delightful if she wasn't going to be married off to her oafish cousin or whatever he is, but that you can't change things overnight. You can't magically will that they be different. You can't hatch a different society out of dragon's eggs and expect that the world will just bow down. And I like her for that. I think she's fun. I hope she's happy. It would be nice if someone in George R. R. Martin's universe, you know, made it. Alice Karstark can be the final girl.
I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we are with the savage people, we could just make a jump to Daenerys' very own origins and go to the Dothraki, because I think their view on rape differs from the wildlings and the Westerosi society very much. And if I would try to pinpoint it, I would say that rape for the Dothraki is a way of exerting power. When they defeat an enemy, they also rape the women. It is a show of force, a show of success, and you simply do it to demonstrate that. It's not really about that your blood is heated, like it is in the Westerosi Wars, although that plays a role, of course, and it is not pure lust. It is also a very important statement. And
well, it's not sex, it's about power, which is sort of the
right.
modern understanding of rape. And
right.
it's also something that the Greyjoys do as well.
Yes. Although the Greyjoys don't do it quite the way the Dothraki do it. They have this more primal approach to it. You can literally give your own blood to the inferior tribe you just conquered to just show how awesome you are. And the Greyjoys and the Iron Men, they simply take sex slaves. But that is not something the Dothraki do. They rape and then they kill the women. It's just a statement there. And the Iron Men, they take them to use them.
Hmm. Yeah, although... Yeah, no, that's true. Although, I mean, there are sort of different means of achieving the same thing. It's, you know, both are aimed at sort of exertions of power and authority.
Right.
They serve,
yes.
they serve similar purposes.
I find it really interesting that, you know, this is sort of the... As Stefan put it, the origin of Daenerys is her... immersion in Dothraki culture and her relationship with Drogo, which you know it is less clearly non-consensual than it was in the show, but you know it's still, you know, obviously it's statutory rape by modern standards, it's marital rape by modern standards. You know, even if eventually she comes to find a way to make it work for her, and then to actually enjoy it, and then to actually, you know, sexually, and then to actually enjoy it romantically and emotionally as a connection with this person that she grows to love, you know, it has its roots in you know, illegal behavior by contemporary standards. But, you know, it's interesting to me that I think the development that upsets people about Daenerys more than any other, just by going by message board chit-chat, is her sexual relationship with Daario, which is defined entirely by the amount of sexual pleasure that she derives from having sex with this dude, who she finds handsome and, you know, and sexy, you know, dangerous and alluring and, you know, fun to be around and fun to actually be physically intimate with. You know, that's, I've seen that, been like, oh, she just spent the whole time screwing this guy. They hate Daario for it. They hate her for it. You know, and I think we can talk about whether Martin portrays this relationship as being in some way irresponsible, but the whole time it goes on, I can't help but feel like, well, God, for God's sake, let the kid enjoy herself, you know? Like, it's her first real opportunity to sort of be sort of in charge, you know, she's, even when her and Drogo came to a sort of better place in their relationship, you know, she's still dependent on him for so much. Now she's really not dependent on Daario for anything. Like, it's at her leisure that they have this relationship. You know, she's a teenager, you know.
And he's her social inferior, too.
Right, you know. And actually, now that I think about it, maybe that's the ultimate... I've thought often about, you know, particularly Game of Thrones versus Mad Men as television shows. Mad Men I find to be extremely sexy, despite the fact that you can't show nudity of any kind, or, well, I guess you kind of can, but certainly not to the level of Game of Thrones. And I think it's because in Mad Men, for the most part, when the people have sex, it's because they really want to. It's because two people who find each other attractive think this would be a fun thing to do. Whereas Game of Thrones, even at its best, and also in A Song of Ice and Fire, there's always these sort of social relationships that put one person in a position of power over the other, even if they're sort of mutually choosing not to rely upon that in the context of the current, you know, relationship, that's always there. You know, and it can work to Daenerys' benefit, I think, as it does with Daario. But you're right, it's still present. He's still her social inferior.
Yeah, it's a... I mean, I think part of it is also just that, like, pleasure is uncommon in this world. I think it's sort of jarring to people to see this relationship, in part because it's kind of different from everything else that, you know, we've seen before.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of Daenerys' equivalent of the John Egret relationship, now that I think about it. You know, which is one of the few other cases where we see people have sex because they want to, and it's fun, and they care about each other. You know, it's not really, that's really not a window into sexuality that we get very often at all. I mean, I think there's one sex scene between Ned and Catelyn at the very beginning of the books.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I guess Cersei and Jaime. You know, that's one of the very few times we see sex in the context of a loving relationship, whatever the other problems with that relationship may be. You know, so I feel like this really shapes, perhaps this shapes some people's negative reaction to the treatment of women and sexuality, you know, sort of shading over into sexual assault and rape in the books, that you're so rarely presented with an alternative. I think people, that may be what people are responding to so viscerally negatively.
Well, and I mean, you know, not to get all Bikini Kill about it, but I mean, I also think with Dany, there's some, you know, oh, you're doing this while the city is burning, kind of misses the point that, you know, sort of a liberated consensual sexuality is part of what Dany is fighting for. You
right.
know, she's, the personal is political here.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think, to me, that was very clear. And I just think maybe we're now at the point where, you know, the jury is still out, because we don't know when Daenerys returns in the Winds of Winter. I think there's a lot of speculation as to, like, oh, is she going to be born again hard now? Like, is she going to just leave a trail of fire and blood across the Dothraki Sea and into Meereen and all the way over into Westeros? Or will she still retain the sort of reformist impulses and this desire to be a benevolent dictator that sort of governed her behavior in Storm of Swords and Dance? And we just don't know. You know, I would like to see that remain part of her character. But I think without that context of finding out what happens when she returns to Meereen, it's difficult to, you know, render a verdict on what her relationship with Daario ultimately said about, you know, what's a good way to rule and what's a good way to conduct yourself with regards to other people.
Mm. Agreed.
Sounds like we've hit that hour mark. Is that correct, Stefan?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, perhaps, I don't know, Alyssa, but we do try and have Truth in Advertising and keep the Boiled Leather Audio Hour at about an hour. So,
well, thank you for having me. I mean, I think, you know, I love writing about these books because, and this TV show and these comics, because the text is so rich. And, you know, look, we don't have huge continental dynastic wars of succession. We don't stave people in with warhammers on the trident, but we're still very much struggling with the same issues of sexuality and of consent and, you know, sort of sexual liberation that these characters are. And I love writing about them because they are so close to what we all live today.
Yeah. Yep. I know that's why I do it. So
yeah, I can only concur.
And that's how we love to end on notes of comedy. Well, thank you, Alyssa. It was really, really good of you to join us. And again, people, if you like what you heard today, definitely do track down Beyond the Wall. In addition to Alyssa's really, really excellent essay, I think that if you like talking about and thinking about these books and this material at any kind of length, this is pretty much a must-buy. I certainly felt so.
Yes,
so we really appreciate the chance to get to talk to you about this in depth, Alyssa. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will see you next time when we will continue discussion of various essays from Beyond the Wall. So see you then.
See you.